Good afternoon, everybody, and welcome to the February TPG Advocacy Task Force discussion panel. I'm Don Hansen. I'll be your moderator today. And with me is Judy Luther, Debbie Sheridan, Sandra Mikado, Pat Miller, Daniel Antalek, Sam Weick, Beth Edelman, Dr. Carolina Westland, and on her way is Dr. Zazie Todd. She's having some connection difficulties, but hopefully she will be able to join us shortly. So, panel, thank you for being here. Those of you that are guests, thank you for watching. So, last month, Ingrid, who was viewing our panel discussion, commented on the Facebook feed, quote, "For many humans, changing a behavior takes a change in belief," which is a really good lead into this month's discussion, which is changing a pet's behavior by changing human behavior. I know we have all had clients who come to us with a pet exhibiting some undesirable behavior, and our thought is, how do we convince the clients that they are at least part of the reason for this behavior? So today the panel is going to be in discussing some cases where each of us has had to do just that. As we all know, sometimes this is easy, often it's not, because just like pets, sometimes people don't like to have to change what they do and how they live. So I'm going to give everybody a starter question, or I'm going to give us a starter question here, and I'm going to give an example. I'm going to go first of where I had a case where someone other than the dogs in the dog's life was really part of the problem. And this one kind of solved itself, and I'll explain the story to you. So, and meanwhile, be thinking who wants to go next. Don't make me call on you. So, this particular client had a boyfriend who kept encouraging her dogs to jump up on him every time he came over. He'd walk in the doors, the dogs would jump up in greeting. And he would give them all sorts of affection and attention, despite my clients constantly asking him not to do this. Then one day, the dogs were out in the backyard. It was mud season here in Maine. That's one of our seasons here where everything turns to mud. And she was letting the dogs back in, and they were quite muddy, just as the boyfriend happened to show up in a brand new suit. Guess what the dogs did? Whereupon the boyfriend exploded. My client said, "We're done. We're not going out to dinner. Don't bother ever coming back. There is the door." Solution solved. It's not always that simple, but I thought that was a very elegant and probably appropriate solution to this particular problem. Who wants to share one next? Debbie, and then Sandy.
I really like that story, and I wish more people got behind their dogs like your client. That was awesome. Yesterday I went to see a family who has a 9-year-old Great Dane, pretty old for a Great Dane, and they just got a puppy, and they had me come over because the older dog, they said they were seeing aggression with the older dog. And of course, the puppy was jumping on this older guy, and the older guy was saying, "Hey, I want some space." And what were they doing? They were scolding the older guy named Grayson. And I explained that a growl is great communication, that we should never scold, and that we have to get behind him and protect him. And if we do that, he will maybe enjoy the puppy when he wants to. And they were so surprised to hear that, we welcome a growl. So, interesting.
Sandy, next.
Something just happened this morning that happens all the time, that happens many times, is by the time I go to somebody's house, they already had a client. And that client, they already had a trainer. And that trainer, my mom, look at this. And that trainer, visiting from Brazil, 3 months. 3 months visitors from Brazil stay in your house, So the client, the trainer said that the dog needs to walk on your left and you need to be doing heel, 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 heel all the time. So this dog was a beagle and she's doing heel, heel, heel. And then the dog turns and starts to bite her. And I said to her, why are you pressing on the brakes all the time? You're just pressing on the brakes, pressing on the brakes. Think about this as me watching a game, Brazil and Argentina. And the most boring person in the room says, Sandra, how are you? I'm like, are you kidding me? I'm watching this beautiful game. I cannot pay attention to you right now. So I put the dog on a double leash, let the dog sniff. And the dog, I said, I'd rather that you walk a shorter walk, but a sniffing walk. It's a beagle. The dog did not pull. The dog did not redirect. She's like, oh my God. Sometimes it's so simple, but I like to do analogies. I like them to understand, you know, from the dog's point.
Good. Who wants to go next? Beth, and then Judy, and then Pat.
I have a lot of my litter box cases. Half of them are very complex, but half of them are super simple. And it's about people changing their idea of what constitutes an acceptable litter box for the cat. I get it, you know, cats defecate and urinate in your house. And I get that's not anybody's best favorite part about having a cat. It's not my favorite part about having a cat either. But the impulse then to hide the litter box behind a maze of furniture, it creates a lot of problems. And it's easy for me to go in and say, you need to have a big open litter box in the living room. But I get it that people don't want that either. I don't have a big open litter box in my living room. So a lot of it then is about getting people to understand and sympathize with what the cat needs, but also giving the people choice. We always talk so much about giving animals choice and how choice is a primary reinforcer. Choice is a primary reinforcer for all sentient beings, so that includes us. So it's about giving the people choices then about how they're going to change the litter box setup in a way that works for the cat and still works for them. But those cases are so easy because once we find that litter box setup, problem solved, you know? And then they think, oh my God, Beth, you're the amazing cat whisperer. And it's like, not really.
Really?
Good example. Judy, and then
Beth. Well, Beth, I thought you were going to say that you put furniture and things in the way of the human's bathroom, so they had to experience what the cat was going through. That's probably what I would have done. So I'm going to give you an example. I know, next time. I'll give you an example of what happened, and this was my husband. And as you know, spouses of animal trainers are not always paying attention. So
they're often untrainers.
They are, and that's okay.
Judy, they're great examples of what not to do. Like
sometimes they're good examples of what to do. It just depends on the situation. So he likes to play what he calls bitey, bitey, fighty, fighty, where he's grabbing the dog and they're playing. And that's fine as long as the dog knows when to do that and when not to and who to do it with and who not to. And my dogs have always been good at that. Well, one day he was playing bitey, bitey. And later on that evening, he sits on the couch on the floor with his back up against the couch. And here comes my Aussie Rusty, runs up, jumps on the couch, grabs him by the ear and takes off. And he's bleeding. And he said, oh my goodness, what was that all about? And I said, well, you play bitey, bitey, fighty, fighty, and you're sitting on the floor. And that was kind of his way of understanding that we don't always do that. Or we set it up. So we do it at certain times. He does it at certain times when the dog expects it.
Pat.
So I want to start by saying, first of all, I have long said, if we could just change human behavior, we wouldn't have to spend nearly as much time modifying dog behavior. But one of the cases where I find it actually most satisfying to change human behavior is around resource guarding cases, because there is so much myth out there, and unfortunately still some old-fashioned trainers and training classes that convince their clients that they have to teach the dog that they can take their stuff away from them anytime they want. Okay, so I actually like getting resource guarding cases because they're pretty easy. You just stop the human behavior and then convince the dog that having humans near their valuable resources makes more good stuff happen and they don't have to worry about it. So those are like really easy success cases. I love those.
OK, okay. I'm going to have to pick on people since I don't see a volunteer. Dan and then Sam.
I was actually waiting for this moment because I like it when you give me orders. So I'm thinking of a case that I had with an 8-year-old Bichon Frise that was used as a puppy mill breeder for 7 years. Wasn't socialized. Elderly lady, very nice lady, adopted the dog, and Jan is her name. She had adult children and grandkids who would come over to visit, and the dog would see them come through the front door, start growling and barking, would fixate on them that the whole time that they're in the house. And when they got up to leave, the dog would rush up from behind and bite them in the back of the heel. And she was biting hard enough to leave bruises. So there's a pattern of behavior occurring. And I'd like to, before I get into the story, I'd like to cite Henny Youngman. Pat, do you remember Henny Youngman?
Oh, yeah.
I know.
Yeah. Old-time stand-up comic. He told a joke that goes like this. I went to the doctor the other day, and I said, doctor, when I go like this, my arm hurts. The doctor looked at me and said, well, don't go like that. And to that, I'd add, well, that's $100. So my thought is we've got a pattern of behavior here that's been going on for years. So the dog has bitten everybody but Jan. And we arranged a meeting in the backyard rather than go into the house. We've got lots of room. I'm in the yard first. I'm sitting at a table. I've sprayed Adaptil on my clothing. I've got my iCalm dog playing. I've got a big supply of really good food. And then Jan brought her two dogs out. So Brandy is the social dog and Abby is the fearful dog. And Brandy was curious, so she came running up to me and I'm engaging with her. And Abby stayed about 20 feet away barking at me. But she became curious because while I was engaging with Brandy, I was doing some training, teaching touch and look and find it. And Brandy's having a great time. So Abby came up and started sniffing. And within a few minutes, I was teaching the same games to Abby. So now we're playing together. I'm tossing a lot of food around so she's foraging, get the dopamine flowing. She actually laid down at my feet on her hip. So a completely different behavior. And all the while I'm coaching Jan on how she could have her visitors model my behavior, but maybe just one person at a time come into the yard and basically do what I was doing, being quiet, not moving my hands around a lot, not making eye contact, scattering food. And when it was time for me to leave, I scattered some food away from me and I stood up and I walked instead of turning my back because that was a big bite trigger. I was walking sideways like an ancient Egyptian and I got to the gate and Abby looked up at me and then she went back to foraging. So I didn't get bitten. The next few sessions we actually worked in the living room where the problem was. She never got aggressive toward me. And then one of her sons came to a session, so I was coaching him, and Mark really liked Abby quite a lot, and he was very dog savvy. So I got some feedback that a couple days later, he came to visit in the living room, and he modeled nice, calm behavior, and when he got up to leave, Abby was fine. So the family started changing their behavior, which eliminated the biting problem, because then Abby felt comfortable. So I thank Henny Youngman for that. That was a good lesson.
And if okay. I can just stick in here, I use that Henny Youngman quote all the time with my clients. Absolutely.
It's pretty appropriate. I like to get some humor yep. into it because yeah. you're not judging people. You're not saying, oh, you've been doing the wrong thing.
Yeah.
You know, and they appreciate, yeah, it makes sense. I just stop doing that and yep. things change.
Funny quotes are really, really good to use. I'm going to remember that one because that's one I hadn't thought. One of them I use all the time, and I don't know the actors or even the movie. And but when I say the quote, you guys are going to recognize it. And it's, what we have here is a failure to communicate.
Yes.
Cool
and
hand, Luke.
Cool hand, Luke.
Okay. There we go.
And Guns N' Roses too.
Yeah, I think that really gets people thinking about it and often helps them to remember it. So I'm going to remember your quote there, Dan. That's a good one to use as well.
I actually use Henry Youngman joke too. It's for people who tell me, when I pet my cat on the tummy, she bites me. And it's like, then don't pet her on the tummy. And then I tell them that joke.
Right.
Yeah.
Yep.
Sam Zessi, and then Dr. Westlin.
In December, I stayed for a couple of days with a family geographically quite a ways away from me, but an adult family, and everybody are recovering from various addiction issues. And three dogs in the family, and one dog was scared, and to them, their triggers were never the same, and they had a tendency to be loud and scolding, and they get frustrated and aggravated, etc. And after a couple hours there, I started to talk to them about their recovery and asking them about the steps that they used every day to continue in their recovery. And as we talked, I would occasionally glance over at the dog that they felt was the problem dog. And it was interesting to watch some light bulbs go on as they were discussing their recovery process and their daily application of the process, for them to understand now that just as much as recovery is a very scary thing, and staying in a recovery, their dog was having its own fear issues. And as they did not want people to judge them or scold them or become frustrated with them if they were having a bad day, because recovery is difficult, it finally got through to them that if their dog's having a bad day, especially when a dog is scared of things. And it was nice, because after spending a few days with them and in the follow-ups I've done with them since, they changed the environment in the house. They lived in a very large house. They created an area where this dog could have all to itself, had a doggy door to itself. It didn't have to worry about interacting with the two other much older, smaller dogs. They've got 40 acres for this dog to run and play in. He gets to hang out with the horses whenever he wants to. And it's just that the whole dynamic changed when they kind of stepped back and asked of themselves with their dog the same thing they would ask from each other or other people to help them with their recovery process.
I think that's a good example of where you've got the humans to have some empathy, and that helps them understand that, okay, this is why we need to do this. Zazie, and then Carolina.
I love those examples where the change we need is to get people to provide more exercise and enrichment for their pets. And I'm especially thinking of indoors cats, actually. I know this applies to dogs often, but you can get indoors only cats can become very frustrated when they don't have enough to do, especially if they're home alone for a lot of the day. And sometimes when you have a frustrated cat, the person perceives that the cat is attacking them, because they might be going for the person's ankles when they're walking along, for example. Or if they get up to leave the room, the cat might actually attack them near the door because they don't want them to leave, because then the cat's going to be bored. So what you want them to do then is to provide lots of enrichment for the cat, food, puzzle toys, maybe some training, lots of play with the one toy and toys of their own, and so on. And I think everybody's heard the idea that dogs need to have a job, so you can get that message across more easily, even though lots of people don't give their dogs enough to do. They know that you're meant to give your dog a job to do. So if you say you have to give your cat a job too, that's a bit of a surprise for people, but it's a useful way sometimes, I think, to help to explain it to people that their cat, because the cat isn't just an ornament in the living room. They need something to do to keep them busy all day. And when you provide that kind of enrichment, then it solves a whole lot of other issues.
Very good. Carolina.
Yeah. I've been listening and I realize I'm the only person in the room who doesn't work hands-on with clients, I believe, and never have. I've consulted in zoos and I've done a lot of teaching, but I think I have to go to myself and my own my own human behavior example. And actually, my trainer is he's right here. And that would be Oscar, my cat. And Oscar is he is not a very affectionate cat. He doesn't sort of solicit pets and cuddles very much. But sadly, I must say, because I could just smooch him, and sometimes do. But I try to sort of invite. I try to, you know, consent tests and everything. And so those few moments every day where he actually does ask for cuddles, I have to just stop everything and oblige. And in these last couple of weeks, that is at 4 o'clock in the morning when he jumps up next to my pillow and he goes, "Rawr!" And I go, "Hi." And then I put up my hand and he goes like this, you know, with his face like that, and I feel I get all warm and fuzzy, so I'm really reinforced for that. And then I also swear because I realize I'm creating a huge, you know, I'm not sleeping that well. So that would be one example from my personal experience.
Okay, well, I think everybody had really good examples, and in some ways, I think we made it look a little too easy, maybe. I'm going to give an example next of one where I was not able to change the human's behavior, but I didn't let it change mine. I'm going to talk about my wife here. And there was a point in our life when two of our dogs decided for like 3 days in a row, "I'm going to wake you up at 4 o'clock. Wasn't because either one of them had to go to the bathroom. They just know we get up and we get fed. And she did it the first day. And I said, "Well, did anybody have to really go?" And he said, "No." She said, "One of them, I think it was Dulcie, just ran straight to the kitchen." And I said, "Well, you don't want to get in the habit of doing this, or you're going to be doing it every day for the rest of their lives." Told her the same thing again on the third day. And I think I added to it, "Just don't count on me to get up at 4 o'clock. It's not happening." And we went on that way the rest of the dog's lives. It worked. No one was upset about it. The dogs were happy about it. But sometimes we can't always change the human's behavior. And sometimes it's not a big issue. My mom lived with us, and when she was older, and she had some cognitive issues. And also, like a lot of elderly folks, she didn't always eat as much as she should. I'm going to give you a second example here that I just kind of let go. And where I noticed something was going on was the only meal all of us had together at any point was dinner. And suddenly, one night, Chicken, who is my golden, was sitting right next to Mom with her head on Mom's lap. And this is one of those moments that, you know, kids sometimes relish. "Mom, when did you start feeding Chicken from the table?" "Oh, I never did that." "Mom, remember when I used to tell you that?" "Yeah, well, same thing going on here." Now, lucky Chicken was not a noisy beggar. She didn't irritate anybody about it other than Mom, and Mom wasn't irritated, and it made Mom get rid of the half of her sandwich she wanted to hide from us she wasn't eating, which I was a little concerned about, and I did cut back on what we were feeding Chicken, but life went on. But what other stories were, give us some examples of where you weren't able to change behavior. Pat?
If I can just insert something before we get to that, which is, it's important for us to remember that we need to respect what the client wants their dog to be. That we don't go into training and behavior modification trying to make these all the dog we would want to live with. And if a client wants a dog to do something that we find offensive, as long as it's not going to get somebody injured, we need to be okay about letting that go.
Yeah. Exactly. And I really, you know, if Kicken would have become obnoxious, or if she would have gotten grossly obese because of that, I would have cared. I would have done more to change it. But, you know, it was harmless, and it helped create a bond there that was good for both of them. So sometimes turning the other way is the appropriate thing to do.
Don, I say to my clients, not everything is a thing, you know. Pick your battles, not everything is a thing. Yeah, you know, if you're gonna address every single thing, you know.
And like, I agree with
that. I mean, sorry, Judy. Sometimes I get very sad, actually, when people say, oh, you're not gonna like this, but my dog sleeps with me. I'm like, I have a 75-pound dog. I rehome my husband, my dog sleeps with me every single day. It increases bond. It's the best thing that, oh, really? But isn't it bad? Is it going to dominate? Dominate what? Every single resource is provided by you. What else is left, right? Judy, I'm sorry.
It's okay. I agree with Pat, and I think we have to help people get their expectations in line with where they should be, right? So I don't worry so much about dog behavior as much as I do people behavior. So if someone's doing something that's absolutely damaging or harmful to the dog, I'm going to change that person's behavior. And I'm going to give you an example real quick of my favorite. I probably should have used this as my other example. I went to a man's house, and he was kind of big, burly guy, you know, very intimidating to some people, not to me. And he kept saying, I should be able to take my dog's bone, and I should be able to do this, and I should be able to do that, all around trying to take things from the dog. And I have told this story before, so y'all may have be bored with it by now, but I was writing him some notes at the end of the session, and he was sitting across the table from me. It's a Friday night, about 6:30 p.m. and his wife cracks open a beer and sets it in front of him. And without taking a second, I grabbed the beer and I put it way over where he couldn't reach it. And he looked at me and he said, and I said, it's not really fun when people take your bone, is it? And his wife was like, that is the best could have ever done. And that was the last time he ever thought he had to take something. And another example I'll use is, if I go to Starbucks and you take my coffee, I am going to stab you with that little, you know, stirrer thing. But if I have five or six coffees there and you come up and you want to take one, have at it, have as many as you want, but leave me mine. So it's all in how we relay the information to them, and also letting people know that not everything is a thing. You know what, and if you make a thing out of it, it becomes a thing. So just, well, you know, I have fun with it.
I think you have all alluded to this, and then I'll get to Pat, that lots of people think it's a thing because there's still lots of misinformation about there. Sometimes other people in our roles, books and stuff, that are telling people it's a thing. You know, if you let your dog sleep on the bed, he's going to be running the country in the next thing you know it, which
God,
some days
nice.
I think might not be a bad thing.
That's true.
You know, so we have to deal with that too. So I'm going to let Pat go, but something else, if I think some comments would be good on, and Sam and Dan both had cases that involved a multitude of people, which can often, you guys were able to resolve that fairly easy. But sometimes the more parties you have involved, or the more animals involved, or more of both, the more difficult it gets. So if someone wants to address that after Pat's turn.
So I just wanted to say, I do get a lot of clients who come to me doing behaviors that I want them not to do, for the most part, because they've been to somebody else who told them that was what they needed to do. And by far, the vast majority of them are thrilled, delighted, when I tell them that they don't need to do those things anymore. And that, yes, it's okay for the dog to sleep on the bed. And no, they don't have to be alpha dominant, all that stuff. So the vast majority of my clients are, it's really easy to change their behavior because they're thrilled. On the less common occasion that I can't convince someone that they need to change their behavior, if it's something that's really critical to our success in modifying the dog's behavior, then that person, if I can't convince them, then that person isn't my client anymore. For our own sake, for our own mental health and our own sake, we need to be able to let go of those people and realize that's not our fault.
Yes.
Good point. Sure. Beth.
So, I mean, another side of not everything is a thing is that not everything you look at is what you think it is. And one of the ways that I've had a lot of success with my clients is, you know, whenever when you first talk to a client, and before I visit the household, I have a phone call with the clients. Yeah. And when we talk about the behavior, they're always telling me the behavior in terms of their emotional reaction to it. So then Fluffy goes off. And I say, okay, what does that mean? Specifically, what does Fluffy do when she goes off? What does that look like? And I get them to start describing the behaviors that they're seeing rather than interpreting them. And what I find, and then we talk a little bit after we get, you know, we have that discussion of what does it mean when Fluffy goes off and what does she do? And what do you do before, you know, so that we're trying to identify triggers without me using that terminology. I get them to start thinking about looking at the cat's behavior as something they're just watching without interpreting. And I find, and we do that in the phone call, and then I tend to see them about a week later when we start actually doing training. And I find that by planting that seed, by the time I get there a week later, they're actually more likely to view the behavior as behavior rather than labeling it. So they're already seeing something new and different than what they did when they first contacted me. And that is enormously helpful. Enormously helpful, because they're no longer looking and saying Fluffy is an aggressive jerk. They're saying, okay, Fluffy does this, and then I do this, and then Fluffy does this. So they're looking at behavior as behavior, and that is super, super helpful for changing their behavior as well, because they're understanding that the animal is not expressing an inherent character trait. They're doing a behavior.
Right. I think that's so important, Beth, you know, describing the behavior, because we get calls all the time. This dog's aggressive. This cat's aggressive. You know, what's happening? Why is the dog doing this? You know, even a dog stuck on a leash, right? I don't know about you coming down the street. All I know is that I'm stuck here. You know, how can we help the dog or the cat feel better? So that's huge.
Well, the other thing too, Beth, you've done there is you've helped them to have a success, which is a reward to them, which makes them continue to do things as well, which sometimes is important. And sometimes the most difficult thing is the client wants to get from A to Z in one step. Mm-hmm. And you have to explain there's more than 25 letters between them. Sometimes there's a whole lot more, and they have to do it a little bit. So if you can find something little where they can be successful, it can be very helpful. Pat?
I mean, that's a good point, Don, because one of the
again,
things when I come to see them and they start telling me, oh, so we noticed actually Fluffy is doing this and doing this, I always say, oh my God, now you're thinking like a behaviorist. That's so amazing. They get reinforced for changing the way they're thinking.
Wow.
Yeah.
Ahead,
so I
Pat.
Think in that same topic, I never, in my writing and my talking to people, I never say this is an aggressive dog or this is a reactive dog or this is a whatever dog. Yeah. This is a dog with some aggressive behaviors. This is a dog with some reactive behaviors.
Right.
And for the most part, you know, even if a dog is coming to see me with some aggressive behaviors, he's a nice dog most of the time, or his people wouldn't be investing in trying to help fix this one behavior.
Right. Actions don't, it's in that moment, you know, it doesn't make you who you are. If I yell at you because you grab my half inch sundae, I'm not an aggressive person. I just don't want you touching my half inch sundae.
So sometimes it's not as much, it's about changing the people's behavior, but sometimes that involves in convincing them to also change the environment. You have some examples, and we'll let Sandy go. And then if you guys have some examples of where you've had to do that, because that's not always an easy thing to get people to do either. So Sandy, go ahead.
So when I'm working with a reactive dog and I get to the client's house, they are broken. You know, I know what it does to the family. I know what it does to the household. I know what it does to the marriage and all that. So what I say, I usually say that this, you know what, let me show you what you have, but let me show you what you don't have. We go to the park, forget training. We go to the park, we put the same dog that is like, you know, super, super reactive on a short leash. We put this dog on a long leash in a people's park in the middle of the week. And I said, here, this is your dog when your dog doesn't have to look over his shoulder every single time to whatever it is out to get him. And they're like, oh my God. I said, yeah. So I always try to explain, you know, what is going on? Like, put yourself in the dog's place, you know?
Yeah.
Exactly. Exactly. Sam.
You know, you brought up before about multiple person households. And on the occasions when I do get to see dogs already without bite histories, I always have everybody there. And I have to tell you, I love when kids are there.
Yeah.
Because kids don't lie. And what parents see or describe and what each child sees and describes generally are 180 degree polar opposites. And I also find out the parents are scared for their kids, and they may have a child or two that are scared of the dog. So we have this giant fear thing going around. But if we can get the kids to talk, if we can get, or if it's an all adult family, like what I was talking about, getting everybody's viewpoint, getting everybody's thoughts on what they see, what they interpret, what they feel. And sometimes you'll hear people go, well, that's not the way I see it. And it's like, just wait. Everybody gets a turn here. And we start to bring things out. And then we ask them, and Beth, you alluded to this, you know, there's no ambiguous terms. We get into the meat of it. You know, what does that look like? What does that mean? And it's amazing to see how many different interpretations of an animal's behavior you will get, whether it's adults and kids, whatever it might be. But it is interesting that in almost every case over the last 17 years, where people have listened to each other, and now we start to see some communication among the people, that we start to go, huh, you know, and again, light bulb moments. And then we start to see where, oh, wow, well, maybe that's because this is happening when, and then whatever, we're finding the common denominators, and it makes things a lot easier. The other thing too is, one of the easiest things to teach people, especially when they have a fearful animal, is to give it space. Sandy, you were just talking about it, right? The long lead, short lead. You know, I can't tell you how many houses I went to, and I start redecorating their houses from the
moment. Yes, feng shuiing the house. Yeah.
Right? We're moving coffee tables, dining room tables, yes. You know, whatever it is, the yes. whole nine yards, moving stuff everywhere.
Yeah.
These giant open spaces, or things like people just crowding their animal.
Yeah.
You know? And that's usually tough with children because they do love being around their whatever their companion animal is. And so with that, I just had this the other night with a family. Kids 8, 11, and 13, right? And everybody wants to play with this new puppy. And the puppy's very cool, but the puppy gets puppy tired, right? And then it gets a little nippy sometimes because it's tired. So what I did was I told the kids, all right, the next time your brother or sister is sleeping, I want you to go in and bother them. And the parents are like, what are you, nuts? And I'm like, no, because believe it or not, that will get the point across. Because I don't want to be bothered. Exactly. No, but getting everybody's viewpoint is just so important in a multi-person household. And it's also getting the viewpoint of every animal in that household, if there's a multi-animal household. A little bit harder to do, but still can be done. It's not, you said something before, you know, we make it sound easy. In some ways it is. If we get people to stop, slow down, calm down, now they can think. Because what happens, just like with animals, once that cortisol is shooting into the brain, right? Slow down, calm down. Easy voice, easy postures. From us, get them to do it, get them to breathe, get everybody to realize, listen, we're not in a life-death situation here. Tell me what you love about your dog. Tell me what your dog loves about you. I know about this stuff. Tell me what the good stuff now. Because it's so hard. In my questionnaires, I ask people, tell me the 10 things that your dog looks forward to every day.
Yeah.
Other than being fed. What else does your dog look forward to? Nobody ever gets to 10. Half the time, people don't get to 5. Changing people.
No, it is. And in some ways, changing societal norms. I mean, at least where I live, everybody's constantly in a hurry. You know, for people to sit back and breathe. I mean, a lot of times I sit back and, why did you even get a pet? Dan, you had your hand up like you wanted to contribute there.
Yeah, I've got a story that is multi-person household and environment changing. So a lady that lived alone allowed her adult son and daughter to move back home with her. So now you've got three people in the home. She adopted a dog, adolescent dog that had some issues, kind of fearful, reactive on leash. But one of the things that the lady was concerned about is the dog would take books off the bookshelf and chew them. And talk about the environment. The bookshelf was very low to the ground. It was in the hallway. It's right where the dog's going to be. So first thing I suggested is let's put the books somewhere else where the dog can't get them. No, that's not convenient. We're not going to do that. So every week I'd go back and we'd do training. We're teaching things like leave it and touch. The problem was that the son and the daughter wouldn't even acknowledge me. It's not like they even knew I was there. They had nothing to do with the dog. They didn't like the dog. They didn't want the dog in the house. It's not even their house. And, it was frustrating to the mother. And they convinced her to put a shock collar on this dog. So I talked her out of that and took the shock collar. So I suspected the adult kids were sabotaging the process. And I went back 1 week. I think it was week 3 or 4. So the dog had already destroyed 3 or 4 books. And I saw that all the bookshelf was empty. All the books had been moved. And the owner kind of sadly showed me the book on Buddhism that was signed by the Dalai Lama, or what was left of the book. And that was the motivator to change that. And I'm not sure that when the lady wasn't there, that her kids weren't giving books to the dog to destroy so that she would be resentful of the dog and maybe get rid of this dog.
Yeah.
So dog was fine when I worked with it. We'd go out in the neighborhood and the leash reactivity, I think, was more frustration. The dog was fine, but the environment was not.
Zazzy.
I like that story. And I think you can get similar kinds of issues sometimes in households where you've got an issue between the dog and the cat. And it turns out that the cat is more a one person's cat and the dog is more someone else's dog. And so you've got those interpersonal issues there where the dog person especially seems more likely to be the one who doesn't want to change things, but it can happen either way. And certainly I've had cases where they said, well, the dog isn't trainable. We can't do anything about the dog, to try and help the cat. And it's really caused issues between the people because the cat person obviously has different expectations than the dog person does. And then you have to get both each of them to understand what it's like for the dog and what it's like for the cat, and how even if the dog isn't actually going to attack the cat still needs to feel safe, for example. But that's another way in which those interpersonal relationships can kind of really affect what's going on there.
Well, and it gets back to our topic last month where we were talking and trying to describe what do we really do, and that's you're a relationship counselor at that point almost, and it is one of the things why we need so many skills to accomplish what we do. Who else has something to add? Or do you need another thought-provoking question? Beth?
Well, just Just reminding, I'm sorry. Just reminding everybody of Nicole Wilde's book, It's Not the Dogs, It's the People.
Jazzy, I think you make a very good point about fear. And a lot of times when I'm talking about fearful behaviors with clients and they say, oh, but I've never hit her. Oh, but the dog's never bit her. Oh, but the kids have never chased her. I always say to them, has your house ever been robbed? And sometimes people say yes, but a lot of times people say no, my house has never been robbed. And I say, well, then why do you lock your door? You're afraid of something that's never happened. Why are you doing that?
That's good. I like that. I'm going to use that, Beth.
I think fear is at a lot of root of a lot of the stuff, and people don't really understand it. I mean, the number of one of the most frustrating things I find where I've given up on trying to change people, and where I often don't go to large groups of people with dogs anymore, because I would say in my experience, 10% of the dogs there are giving either outwardly reactive and saying, I want to go home, I don't want to be here, or the dogs that are frozen in fear. And I have tried approaching those people and tried to explain that maybe, you know, give the dog space, or maybe this isn't a place where they want to be. And I've been screamed at enough that I just choose not to go to those things anymore because, yeah. Any tips?
Can I say something?
Yeah.
So, Don, when I was teaching group class, there was always one dog that was like really, really acting up. And the clients, for the pet owners, was just, they were so embarrassed. And they were so, so I remember saying to them, next week, I want you to come without your dog. And I want you to see that your dog is not the worst dog here. You sit and you watch. And I do the same thing when they're walking the dog. Oh, the other dogs don't do that. My dog is the only, walk the same time without your dog and look at everybody else. You know, your dog, if today your dog is the worst dog here, tomorrow is not going to be the worst dog here. They get so embarrassed. When I started, when I got Maya 13 years ago, they used to yell at me, get a trainer. And I had a thing, a magnet on my car, Learn Behaviors Dog Training. My neighbor said to me, wow, you're really working on that dog, right? You have a trainer here every day. So we get in bed. I said, no, I'm a trainer. Oh, you're a trainer? Because I'm supposed to have the perfect dog, right?
Yes.
And I have the perfect dog who taught me empathy.
Right.
You have to have empathy to these people that are broken. I signed up for this. I walked into a shelter and I said, I want a dog that nobody wants. And I say this to them all the time. I signed up for this. You did not. So the first thing that I'm going to ask you to do is forgive yourself. Forgive yourself from losing it from time to time. It's not easy. And nowadays it's a lottery. Even if you get a puppy, it's a lottery. You don't know what you're getting, you know, with a 33.75% doodle, you know, you don't know what you get.
Well, no, right. That's a very good point. And I've done that in classes too. I've suggested, why don't you come back next week without the dog and see what's different and just watch everybody else. And see, and that can be a real wake-up call for people and can be very, very helpful. Or sometimes I had one family that all, I encourage them to come as families, but when you've got seven people coming with one dog, yeah. All with their own agenda, I finally had to say, I think you need to cut this back to two because one, you know, we've got four other dogs and their families here too, and our room's a little bit just not set up for this, but that's important too. Judy.
I just tell people, first of all, you don't want the perfect dog because that's boring. And secondly, nobody cares what your dog's doing because they're worried about their own dog.
Exactly.
And that will help them a lot in class because nobody really cares. They're so concentrating on that one bad little thing they think their dog's doing.
Sure. But, you know, like what Sandy said, I mean, you know, I have my dog who's afraid of the world. And some of you may have heard me say this before. Someone told me they were at a party and one of my neighbors said, how good can I be with the dog that I have, you know? But I learned so much from him and I'm not trying to make him the guy who can walk through the center wearing a shock collar, you know? I respect him for who he is.
Acceptance. This is the main thing. This is the most rewarding thing for me when I'm working with a client that when I see that there's acceptance, you know.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Sam.
As a species, humans hate to admit that we are afraid. And if you think about all the words that we have come up with to mean fear without saying fear, right? Being embarrassed is being scared, right? A lot of the dogs I work with, we do basket muzzle training. And I hear people, oh my God, people are gonna, and I'm like, think about this. Your dog wearing the basket muzzle is the only dog out there that can't bite somebody, right? So if people run away because they see your dog wearing a basket muzzle, first thing is your dog's thrilled because it's one less thing that they have to worry about, right? Everybody else is safe. And the rest of the world are just stupid humans, right? Because they don't get it.
Yes.
And you think about this when it comes to just in general, like for the limited dogs I work with, you know, we go out to work in parks and we work in huge areas. And there's always going to be that person who just wants to come and pet somebody's dog that I'm working with, whatever. Mm-hmm. So you know what? They go on Etsy, because I've done this with my own dogs, and you get a nice personalized vest that says, stay back, need space.
Right.
And it is amazing how much people will pay attention to that before they'll pay attention to me or a client going, please step back. And I tell them all the time, listen, humans are stupid. By nature, we are stupid, right? And we do stupid things. And the rest of the animal world looks at us going, Jesus, God, what a bunch of idiots. So don't worry about what the rest of the world thinks. Be the advocate for your dog. Enjoy your dog. And otherwise, just put all the rest of it out of your mind. Don't be embarrassed. Because you know what? Honestly, the rest of the world, they don't give a rat's, you know what, anyway. Right?
You segued into something we've only kind of skirted the issues on. We've talked about working with families and people in the same household, but the total strangers sometimes are the hardest ones.
Well, one of the ones that we should run. How many times have we told clients, listen, the one who walks up to you saying, oh, but I'm a dog person, is the one that you need to pretend that you're Carl Lewis doing the 100-meter dash to get away from, right?
I had dogs all my life, yeah.
Yes, oh, yeah, there's that right
now. All dogs love me.
All dogs love me, yes.
Right. Exactly. All dogs love me is the big one.
I tell my clients that run into people like that those people have a tattoo on their forehead that only dogs can see, and it says, bite me.
Yeah. Well, again, we get back to the whole stupid humans concept, right?
Yeah.
But, you know, so many times you go into a person's house, oh, you know, you're probably going to think I'm bad, you know, because I let my dogs, you know, sleep with me or whatever. I have some clients who have actually made chairs for their dogs to sit at the dining room table with them while they have dinner.
Oh, I love that.
And you know what? I don't care. You decide what you want your dog. We'll figure out if this is something we can do.
But it's sad that they have to apologize for that, you know.
Yes,
that's apologize the thing. Why, for being so nice. Yeah.
But we're so scared, and we're also always worried about being in control. Every situation, we've got to be in control. We've got to be in control. And it's like, Jesus, God, no, you don't. Right? Think about has a purpose to it. They don't waste time, they don't waste energy, they don't waste effort.
Pat, then Carolina.
I just wondered if everybody saw the vest that was on Facebook the other day, the dog vest that said F off.
Yes, I saw that.
Yes.
Yeah. That was from Justice Class. Yes, I saw that.
Oh, I missed that. I'll have to go look for that.
There's no negotiation there, right?
That's right.
I love it. Yeah.
Yeah, you're depending on the person to be able to read, but you know. Carolina, you were going to add something.
Yeah. So just reflecting on some of the things that have been said about the stupid humans. So one thing that I've been really interested in is how we, and also that you started out saying, Don, that we change behavior by changing beliefs. Mm-hmm. So our knowledge base, what we know. So this is what we know. And here's some new information. And so we have to sort of look at that new information and say, am I going to believe that? Is it true or is it false? Am I going to accept this to be true and sort of bring it on board, or am I going to reject it to be false? And so I'm, you know, I get hung up on things like this. So I'm really interested in what's going on here, because we tend to make mistakes in both ways. We tend to reject information that's true, and we tend to bring aboard information that's false. And so these cognitive biases that play into this and explain it, I think, is really interesting. And who was that? That was Beth touching on one of them before, with the mere exposure effect, that you said that just bringing up something in a conversation and, you know, asking them to look at the behavior will sort of be a way to open that door to help them bring on that new piece of information, which is that looking at behavior is interesting, or, you know, gives information, is a way to look at animals and try to understand what they're doing. I don't know how often this happens to you, whether the clients that you have are sort of that you have to struggle a lot in this sort of classical, you know, that they want to use corrections and you're suggesting other paths, and because that can really clash, and that can be an instance where no matter how much information you're throwing at them, they are rejecting it as false.
Sometimes they're just too late, you know.
Sometimes I think it was Pat that said it earlier. Sometimes you just have to decide this client is not going to be a good fit because they don't want to hear what I have to say, and it's not going to be good for my emotional health.
But to be good with that decision is the hardest thing in being a dog trainer for me. Too, because I can say that and I'm like, but then to be okay with that, that's an exercise, you know.
No, it is. That might be a topic for a panel at some point. I need to kind of wrap us up here. We're getting towards the end.
We need more time, Don. 1 hour is too little.
I just want to share one comment we had via Facebook from Monica, who said that's why she so appreciates the slow dog movement and what Turid Rugis has taught people for. And she's been a big influence on me since I got in this profession on taking dogs for what they are and giving space and just being slow. So thank you, panel. This has been a very, very good and lively discussion. What we have coming up next month, and we kind of hinted at some of this, unrealistic expectations, where do they come from and how can we diffuse them? I think that's another really, really big topic. So come with some examples that you might have there, because and it kind of hits on what Carolina was talking about at the end there. And I have to say, from a societal viewpoint right now, the whole what is true and what is not, it's a huge societal issue that expands well beyond canines and people. And so that's, you know, we should have some thought about that, because we may have to do things a little bit differently. The other thing I want to add, on April 17th, we're launching something new. We're not going to end this format, but we're going to mix it up with a series we're calling Conversations About Compassionate Care and Connection. And our first guest is going to be Laura Donaldson, and it's going to consist of a couple of us from the advocacy division or advocacy task force interviewing that individual. We've got another one of those coming up. We haven't scheduled it yet with Carolina, but we're going to try to mix it up to present information in different ways, because we think that's very important too. But thank you so much. I hope everybody has a real good week, and hopefully we'll see you in March. Take care.
Bye.
Bye.
Bye. Bye.